Thank you, Donny. Hello and welcome. Thank you ever so much for having me. I feel really privileged to actually be in this environment and to hear some of the things that preceded my talk, and hopefully by me getting my excuses in early, some of the talks that have preceded my own are really going to help flesh out some of the theoretical and technical aspects that are maybe somewhat absent in my talk. So I'd like to, in an attempt to honour the tradition of a phenomenological perspective, I'd like not to introduce this embedded study of police officers and staff during or undergoing organisational change myself, but to allow a constable to provide the opening epigraph. It's like a siege. It's us against them, and we survive by ourselves because we have to. Certainly a powerful reflection on the experience of operating environment of some of the police officers are currently facing across the UK, and one in which I hope draws distinctive attention to understanding change from a first-person perspective. Us, them, survival, a siege, all to be explored. So I'd like to start by briefly discussing the changing and changeable nature of policing as a social construct by way of getting to some of the more relational aspects inherent within organisational change and those specifically found in the policing context before moving on to straight into the constituent themes of the experience studied and some of the implications briefly of phenomenology in organisational change. The changing organisational remit for UK police forces is in a relatively advanced state of flux and debate, and this is reflecting in part the rapidly changing social connectivity with expedient knowledge transfer, a globalised network demographic, and of course the national economic austerity. In stark contrast with some of the positive enhancements that such socio-technological changes can enable, criminal exploitation is an ever-present shadow, of which conceptually changes little, but adapts methodologically to exploit such weaknesses. In contrast, the austere economic climates of UK policing, whereby constricting budget forces by way of a material reduction, an introspective view on purpose, I would suggest UK police forcing is facing, or maybe even being affronted with, conceptual redefinition. Anyway, decisive or definitive, it is not, as Jones and Newton seemingly agree, epochal. When they say that, in their criticism of Bailey and Schering, that overstating the degree of novelty attributed to the changes taking place, we are unsure as to what extent it's realistic to present current developments as epochal change in policing. And so merely what I am trying to convey here is that both in policing and in the wider social control context, there is a relational tension that holds the essence of policing, that of the police and the communities that they serve, together. It's in a constant state of flux, and its governing principles are formed through complexity. So what are police forces to do about this, especially when politically the terminology to fight crime seems quite prominent in government rhetoric and illustrates perhaps a narrow and naive understanding of the subtle relationship between police and the communities that they serve. I believe this relationship, ironically, holds some potential to countermand the resourcing challenges, and could actually be strength testing point in the form of quasi-organisational self-defence, a kind of social withdrawal, or as Stevens puts it, a retreating to the core. To then not examine this in and of its own terms and from varied perspectives leaves police forces with a significantly reduced theoretical basis for change, as concepts such as community or neighbourhood policing are increasingly surpassed by an accompanying and seemingly symbiotic resource management and deployment models such as threat, risk and harm, which assesses and then prioritises the most threatening or most harmful situations. Innate strategic and social effects are often poorly conceptualised. Accompanying this, a shift from inclusive to exclusive language is more than simple rhetoric, as Inn states, as it reflects an increasing awareness amongst police officers about the complexity of policing. Of course, our founding policing model is a philosophical paradox to compete with the best of them. The police are the public and the public are the police, as exposed by Sir John Peel in the 19th century. And this raises questions of boundaries and borders in the organisational psyche. With a rise in community interoperability, categorisation and identity further become blurred. When to suspect the victim of whom is a citizen in the public realm of unlawful intent, and of which, proving beyond all reasonable doubt, changes him into an offender is evidentially confusing. who do you ally with, and who could, and can you even trust them, as West Maryland suggested, as the dodgy citizens, as the dodgy customer, enough to ever work with them? Yet, as Skidmore and Edwards highlight, the level of community engagement and visits goes way beyond that which the police service have historically been accustomed to. And this breeds a requirement to think about policing in different terms, both in terms of measurement of success and, more centrally to this paper, its modality of understanding. So conceptually and operationally, we can begin to see some interesting parallels between the organisation at its inception, its current design challenges, and then classical notions of subjective and intersubjective construction, the latter of which is most certainly the poor cousin by way of investment and credence in its authority as a lens in which to understand the situation and how it affects us, to borrow a military term. To clarify, this situation we need to understand is, if to be of any real use, is the point in which the organisation gets called into being, and that which I term the police and public interface. And here Van Manen describes, albeit from an American perspective, quite nicely this police and public interface. The moral contest in which the authority of the state is either confirmed, denied, or left in question and doubt. To the police officer, such contests are not to be taken lightly, for the authority of state is also his personal authority, and this, of necessity, is a matter of concern to him. With such powerful existentialism running through such an observation, it seems more than compelling to view policing through an existential phenomenological lens. And I think this fits nicely with Johnston and Heine's suggestion amongst organisational researchers that there is a general need to be more for a more reflective attitude to the ontology and its consequences on the results. Thus, it's critical to recognise which perspective or from which approach different studies are generated, and this is even more so in multidisciplinaries like change. So I'd like to quickly draw out some of the existential principles of which tentatively emerge as they form the grounding for the phenomenological analysis to follow. Briefly then, one could infer an objectivist stance, and there's every reason to suggest that culturally, most Western organisations would. Change manifestation may be viewed as a deterministic event and, two, predictable with the correct analytical tools. Now, this driver predisposes a quantitative approach to understanding the effects of change, fearing the intangible for its subjective complexity, and also its difficulty in translating to things like monetary measures and determinant outcomes. So, of course, it would be erroneous to uncritically draw lineage from this idea of fearing to a definitional notion of anxiety. But there is a correlation to the inevitable and inescapable openness of the possibility in our reflections upon our existence that Ernesto Spinelli describes as a consequence of relatedness. The fear here is of subjectivity and complexity as a dualism. That is to say that, firstly, questioning one's ability to draw certainty through I statements such as "I know they will resist change," and the plethora of possible causal factors that lead to a self-organising organisation that cannot be fixed in a contingent manner, i.e. if we do X, Y will happen, combines, as what Morast describes, interestingly, with baboons, a continual nightmare of anxiety in which the other represents the unknown and degrades any epistemological knowingness of how things, like the sense-making organisation, are come to know. I.e., if I cannot know myself without difference, yet I cannot determine another, how can I know myself? And maybe, if I don't know myself, how do I know I exist? And this leads us directly back to a classical existential anxiety. And to draw this more firmly into a first-person context, Arukta Kapiya and Skip Tepe neatly highlight what they term as the existential conundrum for police officers in this police and public interface, of how to reconcile authentic freedom and choice in all human subjects. Given this condition, perhaps the epochal developments of police transformational change aren't so much in the changing structure of policing organisations, but in the facing up to of existential tensions such as these, and to the degree in which conscious agency can, or maybe should be, expected and applied when taken in both an individual and a collective tense. So there's much to say about the practical and cultural interactions and engagement of such a commission that I undertook in the deployment of a phenomenological approach to understanding organisational change. But I feel Ian McGilchrist puts this problem quite nicely in this quote, where he suggests that the polarity between the objective and subjective points of view is a creation of the left hemisphere's analytical disposition. In reality, there can be neither absolutely, only a choice between betweenness, which acknowledges itself, and one in which denies its own nature. So, in the conception of my research design, what I certainly hoped for was that this study would at least endeavour to position itself in the eye of this betweenness, whilst firmly acknowledging that the denial of such a position's validity and viability were eminently present within the organisation itself. So the actual research design saw me embed in a quite large geographic area with multiple policing sites, of which I visited randomly and largely just sat there and looked like a bit of a weirdo and spoke to people as and when they approached me or as I felt I wouldn't get violently accosted. And so literally the questions that I would ask if they were either coming to me and inquiring into my existence being there would be something like, and what's the change been like for you? So the change that I'm referring to here is the operating model change. There'd been a big reorganisation of teams, of processes, of policies that was vastly different in the area that I was working in were the first to undergo this change. Hence I inserted into there to try and get a phenomenological understanding of what that change was actually like. And so I want to try and get straight into the essence of what we found. And I want to do that by way of kind of attempting to draw you closer to the narrative and to the account and to the experience of those studied, which I think is arguably one of the primary aims of a phenomenological approach. So the four constituent themes that emerged were the knowledge updraft, hollow promises, the good and the bad, and isolation and remoteness. Now, I haven't got time to go into all of these. I'm going to try and expand on just isolation and remoteness. But firstly, in a kind of a out-of-sequence manner, let's just have a look at the actual essence of this experience. During change, the host organisation is personified, distanced, and naive to a truth, formed through and preciously held by close interpersonal relationships and tacit operational knowledge of the operating environment in which it seeks to change. Ingrained cultural and personal beliefs of the capacity of the host organisation to achieve promises of improvement are experienced through the subject's capacity for evocality. Change in the conceptual idea in itself is subject to scepticism, necessitating a reaffirming of the subject's meaning for being, felt in their ability to act in the world. The transference of knowledge to those seen as the engineers of change constricts the subject's freedom of movement and isolates them. By way of contrast, organisational structures polarise in their proximity and locality to the subject's worldview and forms a felt remoteness. This isolation and remoteness calls into question the subject's raison d'etre, situating them further still in an embodied sense of place and out on the limbness, combined with a contested view of their role in an increasing external demand, an inescapableness confounds the disjunction between the organisation and themselves, a remote outpost under siege. So let's just have a look, and I'm just going to run this up until my time limit, 5 minutes, and then just try and briefly jump onto some very scant implications as I see them. And again, and this is an attempt to honour those of which I studied. So isolation and remoteness, there was a continual set of, we rarely describe this experience using those terms. Mostly the context for this theme was similar to the disjunct of leadership and the front line, and builds largely on displacement of self-knowledge in relation to others, evident in the directedness of change as an extraction, a mining of knowledge as an existential resource used to remain confidently situated in one's environment. Through this sense of isolation, officers conceptualise their position, a combination of geographic position and terrain, as a being under siege. It's like a siege mentality. You develop to protect yourself in order to survive a PC. And as we've seen before, it's like a siege, it's us against them, and we survive because we have to. Now, these comments were not made lightly, and they only come after considerable reflection, or within the last third, I would say, of the discussion. And isolation and remoteness tells two different but closely related thematic accounts. Remoteness is derived from the absence of people, information, understanding, and direction, whereas isolation is formed of the presence of containing elements, such as the pressing demand battering the walls of the outpost, we could imagine. Combined, they give an inescapableness. And again, we could refer this back to a sense of fear. The feeling of being out on the limb was prevalent and not necessarily governed by the geographic proximity to any larger, more densely populated infrastructure, as contrasts in other areas of the force in which I work in. But it was more to do with the unsupportedness that they felt, a sense of being embattled, and the adoption of a defensive position formed subsequently. Now, change is set against a survival disposition. Simply, it's about survival today, as one sergeant says. The physicality of being single crewed, going out to jobs just with a single person, suggested a further compounding of the survival disposition and uncovered a measure of performance degradation. The overarching cognizant framework for this was the degree of personal risk. Going onto a job by your own and thinking, hold on, this could be trouble. It's just not good, a PC. This can be frightening, and more than that, you don't do your job properly. If there's two big lads in the car and you need to stop them, you won't do it. This is just a job and it's not worth risking my life. It's dangerous because there's a lack of resources. You go into a job single crewed and yeah, you'll still go, but you're not giving that member a good public service. And those types of sentiments continue. So through these narratives, there's a deflation and a despondency, a lack of morale, as the officers would call it. But often their closing statements would often conclude with things like this. But we get the job done, but we're a doing organisation. Oh well, it's our job and we do it. You know, an often sombre moment, and in these closing discussions they would present a distancing or disengagement from the main body of the conversation. Change here is related to a mortal recognition of the embodied self situated in the officer's experience. Situated in the officer's existential rationale. Or said another way, the reasoning is their meaningful existence of that which they identified themselves as being officers. The change creates a direct challenge to executing that of which connects officers to the notion of being officers, such as their felt experience of a poor quality service. They are, in essence, just double checking, experience a forcible change of their sedimentary beliefs. The distancing and disengagement from this experience is an attempt to reconcile the absurdity, the knowing unreasonableness of their fragile existence. So that goes on, and that, as you can tell, within the four constituent themes, I continue on that type of depth. But just in order to frame, hopefully, what I would see as some lively discussion afterwards, I'm just going to skip straight to some of the closing remarks. So, again, I feel like I've jumped quite a lot, but some of the implications for the management of change in an organisational development are to say that, as Heraclitus did in the fragments, how can one hide from that which never sets? There's a real problem here with, even in the reportage of what I've tried to present to you today, in using language, and using language in this way that tries to fix things. And fix things that Spinelli says encase and retain terms in discussion change. And so he proposes a view, a move from a worldview into a worlding. That's problematic, especially in my professional context, because to use a word like worldview, I would probably get shooed out the door, let alone even worlding. So, but that's not to deny that phenomenological examination leads to non-linear understanding of and surfaces tensions that can be contended with through the change process. And I definitely believe that there's a desirable utility in the functionality that some of the phenomenological methodological repertoire brings in the very police and public interactions that we've been talking about. And lastly, the existential principles and themes such as uncertainty and choice can provide a framework for contemporary ideas of motivation and ownership in the organisation through understanding of equality. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Actually, that was a slight lie, because returning back to my opening point, I don't want to leave it there. I want to leave it with an officer's words.